the Mad Max Russians, those crazy Russian soldiers who were using Mad Max top techniques. Apparently they watched that movie and they're trying to emulate that. Or is this the face of modern battle? That's a really question that we want to get into. And where is all this leading? We have a great new guest for you today, somebody that you've probably seen on some other shows before. We've actually featured him from the Duran. But we have Stanislav Krapivnik, who is a former U.S. Army officer and political and military analyst, coming to us from just outside of Moscow at the moment. And listen, first of all, just welcome to the show. Grateful to have you on board.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
And I wonder if you can, just for our audience who may not be familiar with it, those who may not have seen you, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and who you have been? Because you have a pretty unique perspective here in that you were a U.S. Army officer, but you currently live in Russia. How does all that work?
Yeah, so I was born in, like I said, in this war, I have a big dog in this fight. I was born in Lugansk. Well, back then it was Borisovgrad. My father was a dissident, so we wound up, he immigrated a family, had a chance in 79 to the U.S. It was funny because my father was a liberal, in the old form of liberalism, not the new whacked out, woke psychopath thing. But the funny thing is, in the 5 years it took him as a political refugee, in the 5 years it took him to get citizenship, he registered Republican. It's one thing on paper, it's another thing in real life. So grew up in the U.S., mostly in South, good North Carolinian. And then joined the Army. Well, I went to university first. Actually, I wanted to join the U.S. Army, enlist. I wanted to be a tanker. And the recruiter in my high school said, well, you're Russian, they'll never let you near a tank. I'm like, well, screw you then, and hell with that. And then after, I guess, a year in at NC State, I joined ROTC and became a tank, an armor officer. I did more than that, obviously, but yeah, so there you go. My family is a military family, especially my mother's family is very old aristocracy from the times of Ivan Vasilievich IV, Grozny, the feared, not the terrible. British propaganda. Grozny means feared. So from those times, my mother's family has been a nobility that served the czars and officers, and then officers in the Soviet Union afterwards. So, yeah, I guess blood calls. And I wound up, I joined the Guard in 93 as an enlisted, and then in 95 got commissioned active duty, and off I went. Went to Germany, went to, got to command a platoon twice. Was XO at a mechanized infantry company, and then it also was a transportation officer for Third Brigade 1ID. Not my MOS, but they had Germany at that time was packed with armor lieutenants. So unfortunately, we didn't really get that long of a time in command because you only got about 9 months, and then they rotate. Thankfully, I had a second chance as a first lieutenant, though. But I had a second chance commanding another platoon, which I took. But yeah, it was for whatever reason they just just packed in everybody into Germany, and so they started tossing lieutenants around all over the place. I even knew one lieutenant. The guy was coming up on first lieutenant, had never commanded a platoon, was an assistant to a general, and the general would not let him go. And I was in that position of a transportation officer for brigade, and I went up to Würzburg to bring the papers in and reports in, and he was there, and I was talking with him. I was like, "Dude, your career screwed." He's like, "Yeah, I know." The general, he said, "He's a good assistant. And I'm not letting him go." And like, he killed your career. I was like, "Yeah, I know." Like, that's it. You know, you're about to make first lieutenant. You've never commanded a platoon. Yeah, you're not going much further than that. And then I was, I can't say I got turned down for military intelligence. I got told to go, I'm not going to use the words that colonel told me, where I could go shove it. Because, when I was in advanced camp, we had a colonel come in for military intelligence. I don't have an accent, but you know, your nationality, your religion, everything's in your papers. You can't hide it. So I went out there talking to him, and it's 1993. I'm like, hey, sir, you know, I don't know if this is going to be a problem. So, oh, yeah, great. Military intelligence. Yeah. Like, you know, sir, I don't know if this is going to be a problem or not. But, you know, I'm Russian. I was born in the Soviet Union. And he looked at me like a pile of crap and told me in very short words where I could go shove it and what I could do with myself, turned around and walked off. Frick.
Now, okay. And I'm guessing that kind of led to some of your career decisions, because as you have said, you were actually a captain promotable, but ended up turning it down and getting out. What was the story there?
Well, honestly, what got me, I'll tell you the truth, is in 99, I was in 18th Airborne Corps G3. And, you know, outside of that brief period, we were polishing off the plan to take Baghdad. Everything was preparing for war with Russia. You know, every scenario was the Russian army, Russian matrices was Russian generals, and that was it. And, you know, this is when Bush is looking in the eyes of Putin and saying, you know, I saw his soul, we were going to work together and all of this. And you're looking at it, and realistically, we're just getting ready for war with Russia. And while I'm an anti-communist, hell, I'm honestly speaking, I'm a monarchist. Constitutional monarchist, but I am a monarchist. And there's good reasons for that, but that's an aside. Americans have a tendency of not being able to send it, but as a Russian in our history. But that's a whole separate issue. But, you know, looking at it, it's like I'm not going to fight my own people. I'm sorry, but I do draw the line at that. And that formed my final decision. And before that, honestly, even before it became I came to CORE, I tried to get into Special Forces, started doing the training, everything else, and then went in for an interview with them. And they said, you know, we've got enough Russian speakers. You're Russian. We don't know if we can get you a top secret clearance. We're not going to bother trying. Like, I mean, they didn't tell me where to go shove it. I'm a captain already. So they're nice about it, but they told me where I could go shove it. So, like, okay, well, thanks. That's nice. And the worst part is, you know, when I was in Bosnia, I was heading up a joint U.S.-Russian team to go inspect a Bosniak base. So those three of us, first lieutenants, you know, two Russian and myself, standing talking. We're waiting for the U.S. MI team to arrive, which is always late as usual. The MI team arrives. Out pops their first lieutenant, walks up, this swarthy-looking guy, starts talking Russian with us. Like, okay, you're not an American. Where are you from? He's like, oh, I'm Armenian. Like, okay, so when did you arrive in the U.S.? Oh, 1990. And this is 96, I think. Yeah, 97. I came in 79, and they said, hell no, you're from you're Russian from Soviet Union. I'm like, so do you have problems getting the top secret clearance? Oh no, I breathe right through. I'm like, okay, that's great. Son of a bitch. Okay.
Yeah.
So the guy. Well,
so then eventually you end up going back to Russia, and then I guess kind of fast forward to where we are here. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why we're really grateful to have you on today is because you kind of have that perspective of seeing what things are like from the Western side and from the Russian side. And specifically, what we're interested in is the fact that you have been to the front lines. In I think you told us before we went on the air here. Eight different times. And I wonder if just real briefly, if you can tell us what was the occasion for you going down there? Are you doing journalistic stuff? Or what was the other purpose that you would go down to the front lines?
Yeah. So I came back to Russia in 2010. I got out in 2004, finished my MBA, was a supply chain, director of supply chain for oil, gas services companies, Cameron and then Halliburton. And then worked as a consultant. And then when all this started, I became a military political expert because I understood NATO. I worked with NATO, not just the U.S., but I mean, I had dealings with British, French, the Germans, obviously with Germany, from different missions. And people started asking. So I started popping up on different shows. First time I went down, on the 24th of December, 2022. Remember that date. Now, as an Orthodox Christian, our Christmas isn't our Christmas is the 24th of December, but on the old Julian calendar. So it's 2 weeks apart from the Gregorian calendar that everybody runs off of now. So it pops up a 7th of January. There's a reason I'm saying this. So we go down there. We're in this big white van packed with supplies. We're taking them down to the front to the guys there, me and a buddy of mine. And we're in this big white van. So it's 24th of December. You got to figure, you know, well, at least we'll have camouflage. It's a big white van, lots of snow. Now, we leave Moscow. It's snowed over. We get down there toward Smotava. There is no snow. It's all green and mud. And the road is really high up and very, very broken. And we're going really slow, not to destroy the suspension on the Ford van. And across this valley from us is a row of hills, just big row of hills. And that's the front line, right? The Russian guys are on the hill, and the enemy is on the other side of the hill. Which is fine because they can't see us across the hills. This was before drones started becoming weapons, when they were just being used for relatively short range and they were still being used for recon. Well, we get to this one valley that's an east-west valley. That's about 4 or 5 clicks across. So, you know, if a direct fire weapon, we'd be dead before we'd know it. And we're moving 2-3 kilometers an hour on this broken road. I'm just looking at it like, crap. You know, if we get hit, you know, welcome, Jesus. How are you doing? You know, I won't even feel it. Well, we get across and we get down there eventually, and we're staying in this abandoned village right behind the hills. And I can hear artillery popping, but there's nothing coming back. I'm like, so why aren't they shooting? What's up there? And the guys are like, oh, yeah, you know, I don't know. But I'm like, well, who's over there? And Ukrainians? Like, no, they're Poles. Because that's all we hear on the radio is Polish. I'm like, wait a minute. Today's the 24th of December. It's Christmas. That's why they're not shooting. That's probably why we survived getting across there. No. On the way back, we found the road right underneath the hills, which was within easy artillery range, but they couldn't see us. Anyway, so and the road was much better, so we could scoot out there. So that was the first time we went down there. And it's been split between I've done some journalism down there, going down there for RT. And I've done, we brought humanitarian aid. Last time we went down a month ago, I was down in Kursk, oblast. We went to Rysk, brought down, it was for the 810th Marine Brigade's field hospital. But they've got civilians, they've got military there. We brought them a washing machine, a refrigerator, 2 operating beds, medicine, water, you know, everything down there. But that's another one. You know, we're in a different white big Ford van driving down. And we took the most direct path to Rysk. Didn't really think about it, but we're running parallel with the border, about 30 kilometers from the border. You know, and we're driving at night. So early in the morning, we're hitting Kursk Oblast. The first thing you see is a burning semi-truck. That was the first victim that we saw coming in. You know, this civilian semi-truck, a guy pulled up to a crossroads to take a left turn, or I guess a left turn, maybe a right turn, but he got a drone right in the cabin. The cabin's all burned out, and the trailer's still burning at that point. So they're just hitting anything that moves in civilian. They always start gunning it. Of course, the problem with those drones, those FPV drones, when they're coming in, especially in the final, they can accelerate up to 150 kilometers an hour. You're not going to outrun the damn thing on a straight line. You may be able to maneuver it but at that speed on the road, you're not going to outmaneuver it either.
Yeah.
If they're coming in from behind you, they'll catch you. I mean, you're not going to do 150 kilometers down most of these roads, especially in a van. For the standard, the people on standard, that's 90 miles an hour. That van was going to hit that 90 anytime soon. Yeah. But we got lucky. We were actually supposed to go south of Rysk. They told us, no, sky's closed. They're just hitting everything. So we wound up in Rysk, unloaded and boogied out of there toward Kursk. And then within 2 days, the road we were on in Kursk got closed because they were hitting everything. The time before that, we were down. I was down with some, with a bunch of officers, retired officers, airborne officers. We were down there delivering aid to different groups, and we drove down. I got relatives down there to begin with that have been being shelled. Okay.
Well, bottom line is that you've got a lot of direct, obviously very direct experience at the front line. Even if you're not engaged in the combat operations, you certainly are observing all this. So let's take a look again. Let's just start there at that, you know, this fog video that was in Pokrovsk here just a couple of days ago. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen two separate comments from it, first of all, is that one, people say, oh, well, you know, this is just, you know, the whole Mad Max thing. It's just that they're just, you know, scrambling. They got some motorcycles, some trucks with no doors on it, no armored vehicles. You see, this just shows that the Russians are just badly equipped, et cetera. Yet I've heard somebody else say, who's paid a lot more attention to this and says, no, this is what modern warfare looks like. There's a reason why there aren't armored vehicles. Russia has them, but they've chosen not to use them in this area because this is what works on the ground. What is your view?
Well, no, the armored vehicles, first of all, there are armored vehicles. And they do get used once in a while. Actually, there's a big push to start using them in mass again because the Ukrainian lines are so thinned out that a strong armored push, while it may take a decent amount of casualties on the initial breakthrough, is going to break through because there's not enough of a defensive line. There's a big push to move back to heavy armored strikes at a company to battalion level. So we'll see. What is happening right now? Well, first of all, tanks are still used, except they're really more being used older tanks, but they're being used as direct fire weapon systems against enemy platforms or enemy fortifications. So what you'll have is you'll have the no man's land in between. You'll have a prepared hold down position for a tank, a T-55 or a T-72. It doesn't matter. I guess T-64. It doesn't really matter. You just need a large gun. Because basically, he's just got a gun platform. You're driving in a hold down position. He's got 32 rounds. He's just banging away with high explosive into the enemy position. Drives off, reloads, comes back to one or two other positions, pops off another 32 rounds or so, drives back out. And you just continue that. And that's how you soften up the direct fire. Or artillery. And then you've got artillery, of course, rocket artillery, drones. FOBs are really good. The modern FOBs, they will go 200 kilometers because they've got a small jet pack on the back of them. So it's not just a bomb, a glide bomb. It's actually got a small jet engine that'll push it out further. So, you know, if you want to engage something within 100 kilometers, you know, a Russian plane doesn't have to get within 100 kilometers of the border. They don't get anywhere near any Patriot or any other systems before launching a FOB. Or if you get closer, and the further it goes. So, and FOBs are, especially if you're hitting built-up areas, that's nasty stuff. When the FOB hits, I mean, it creates a vacuum. And for people who don't understand what happens if you're in a trench, well, first of all, they'll probably bury you if you're in a trench. I've had friends that got buried in trenches. They got just pulled back out from even J-dams. FOBs are worse than J-dams. If you're in a built-up area, an enclosed area, it will literally suck the lungs out of the body.
Wow.
Because it creates a vacuum. It just sucks everything out. Because it's a fuel air explosive, so it just sucks all the oxygen out. And the vacuum, if you're close enough. Now, if you're in a field, it won't do that, but you'll still get the concussion wave and everything else. But if you're in a bunker, it'll just pull the lungs right or lung tissue right out the mouth. It's nasty. But it's effective. Yeah, it's effective. That's a secondary effect.
Now you'd mentioned the fact that the Russians may be considering going back to some of the larger mechanized assaults, not just using tanks as direct fire weapon support systems, but actually in the assault, et cetera. And one of the reasons why that's becoming possible is because of the thinning out of the Ukrainian armed forces. And apparently this has been an objective of the Russians from the beginning, which is the destruction of the Ukrainian armed forces, their military component. That apparently is having some success. And as a matter of fact, that was confirmed not by Russians, but by Valery Klitschko, the mayor of Kiev, where he just said, "We have huge problems with soldiers, with human resources," acknowledging the toll that nearly 4 years of war has taken on Ukraine. He said Russian troops are advancing relentlessly, describing their assaults as, quote, like a computer game. They just keep coming. They don't care about fallen soldiers. Right now, you can only be mobilized in Ukraine from age 25. You could lower it by a year or two to 23 or 22. So they're trying to say, let's expand the amount of troops that we can, or the amount of manpower in our country that we can suck into the war. But is this going to make any difference? Even if they lower it down to 22 years old, is that going to change the manpower dynamic on the battlefield from the whole war?
Well, first of all, Klitschko. Let's begin with Klitschko. Like a typical Ukrainian politician, Klitschko has two sons, 21, 22. They're in Germany, by the way. They're not going to take any participation in your fighting. None of these guys' families are inside of Ukraine. All the ruling elites, their families are some families are in Israel, others in London, in the U.S. None of these guys will ever risk any of their family. This is for the little people to go die, not for the elites. Just to keep it clear. So when they start talking, you know, their only dog in this fight is how much money they can all steal. Yamarov is a perfect example. He was minister of defense for a year. His family was already in the U.S. since 2016. He's bought up a huge amount of properties all over Florida. He did it smart. He did a separate LLC on each one of those. For each one of his family members, they all own one piece of property and they switch them around. It makes it hard to recover. But this is typical. And guys like that are just typical. They're corrupt as hell. And they don't, you know, when they say Zelensky's sending his people to death. Well, who are his people? His parents live in Israel in a mansion. His wife and kids live in London in a mansion. And he's buying up land in the U.S. He bought a casino in northern Cyprus, occupied Cyprus. He's bought an investment bank in England for a small sum, $1.5 billion pounds sterling. You know, these people, they look at all of this. They say this because it's money to them. As long as they keep this war going, they're earning. They don't care how many people are going to be dead. They're not planning on retiring in Ukraine. This is a feeding trough for them and never has been anything more than that. Just this is a better feeding trough under war than it was under peace or a semi-peace. Now, like I said, I've got relatives that have been under fire for 12 years. I've got an aunt in Yasinovata. I went to visit her just to get to Yasinovata. The road from Gorlovka to Yasinovata, it's about 30 kilometers, and you're going under fire. I mean, we're barreling down this road in a Patriot SUV with a friend of mine. God rest his soul. He died in a car wreck delivering stuff, just fell asleep behind the wheel because he's running so ragged. And we're running. You can hear the artillery popping up around us. But the artillery, you know, you can't adjust artillery too well on a vehicle that's going about 110 kilometers an hour. But the drones sure as hell can. And there's burned out cars all over the place. And we get to my aunt, and at that point, my uncle was still alive. And he died of cancer because I couldn't get him to the clinic in Gorlovka because the Ukrainians are hitting taxis. They'll hit anything that moves. I prefer military, of course. But if there's no military target, well, anything else will do. Civilians included, civilians walking in the streets, anything. And I'm standing in my aunt's yard. She's got a crater hole in her yard. You know, her neighbor about 3 months later was killed. And her house had been hit twice before. Another neighbor, they had the roof was removed. I mean, they would just... before the SMO started, the Ukrainians would get drunk and pop a few rounds into Yasinovata. Yasinovata's the front line, basically. It's a population of about 30,000. And they just pop rounds in when they get drunk for shits and giggles. But now they will harass fire randomly into the town every day, you know, 10, 15, 20 rounds, 30 rounds. And I'm saying, I talk to them, I can hear the rounds going over my head. And then you hear them pop off about a kilometer away. And people live with that every single day of their lives. And they've lived with that on and off for 12 years. So why did Russia go in?
They seem to be taking a turn now. And the question is, can the Ukraine side continue to go indefinitely with this? Because there's a lot in the West that think that's the case. Can the Ukrainian armed forces continue to maintain its continuity?
No, they can't. They were heading toward extinction before. Kursk made sure that extension got accelerated a lot. Because what the Ukrainians did when they went into Kursk is they pulled a lot of their best units that were working as fire brigades. right? So they were up and down, particularly in Kupinsk, in the Slavinsk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka conglomerate, agglomeration, in the Pokrovsk area. They were being used as fire brigades, you know, to plug up any holes that Russia was breaking on the line. Well, all these units got sucked up into Kursk, and they just got mauled in Kursk. They left behind about 70,000 bodies. And I was, you know, I did reporting for, we were in Bryansk, and they had the four trucks with about 2,212 bodies or remains, identified remains, that the Ukrainian side refused to take. On the third time, they took them, only under the condition that the families, because they got a list of the names, you know, from IDs, ID tags, on the body IDs. And a lot of these bodies are very, very late stages of decomposition. They've been eaten by pigs, dogs, crows, and gigantic rats. I mean, the rats grow big, really big. They're head to tail, they're the size, they're the length of an AK-47. That's how big those rats get. And they're bringing them back. And the only way the Ukrainian side took that, by the way, was for the families to sign off that they would not ask for any compensation and they would bury the bodies at their own expense. Golly. I mean, that's and there was a train with another 10,000 bodies waiting to be accepted, a refrigeration train. Well, you know, in all those areas, the Ukrainians, just all their best units got mauled heavily. The best units on the front line right now, you know, as if I remember correctly, a combat ineffective of 70%. But these units are down to 20-30%. You know, the brigades are down to less than a battalion size. And these guys, they're done. They're emotionally, psychologically, physically, they're broken, because a lot of these guys have been on there. Some of them have been on there for 3 years, the ones that survived that long. A lot of them, they're done. And what they do is, and this is the elite units, the non-elite units, they will just throw them in as meat. I mean, they do meat runs.
In fact, let me ask you that about specifically about the, well, I can't even say Pokrovsk anymore, because that's all but fallen to the Russian side. That's where that video, the Mad Max video, was actually shot from. But Mirnograd and the area south of that continue to get hit. And from one report I saw, that there was between 5 and 6 brigade elements of the Ukraine side still occupying that area, but they were somewhere around 30% combat effectiveness. Can you tell us anything about that? Is that accurate? And if so, how much longer can they hold out against the Russians?
Well, today we had the first large-scale surrender. 25 guys came out. A lot of times they get shot in the back by their own guys. Well, they'll have drones come in and kill them if they're trying to surrender. And the surrenders, well, you know, to just understand, the problem here, why this war is going so slow, is they're Russians. They may not want to comprehend that they're Russian, but they are Russians. They're ethnically, genetically Russians. We're all the same people. It's the Soviets that broke this up. It was a Soviet project to make a separate Ukraine and Ukrainize the Russian population and make a separate Belarus, divide and rule. And Russians are extremely stubborn. They don't like to surrender. We don't like particularly to even step back. And that's the problem is, you know, if you throw in the Germans, and Germans are not bad soldiers, but you throw in the Europeans, they're going to have a hell of a time, because it's a different mentality. Russians fight to the end just out of spite. And this is what we're doing. We're fighting our own people. So in Russia, it's viewed as a civil war. We're fighting our own people. And this is why it's taken so long. One, we're trying to do minimal damage because it's our own people. Two, it's just, you know, they'll stand there to the end just because. Even if they didn't ever want to fight, they get tossed in there, they get press ganged off the street, and a lot of them will just stand there just because it's just stubbornness. It's ingrained Russian stubbornness. So that's why it takes a long time. But they're breaking anyways at this point, because they're out of food, they're out of ammunition. The Russian army is not going to charge into Mirograd. They've surrounded Mirograd. Pokrovsk has fallen. Pokrovsk is totally fallen. Mirograd is like 10-15%, but it's all surrounded. There's no point in trading men for men. It's a lot cheaper to trade artillery and drones for men. You just sit back. They're not going anywhere at this point. The Ukrainian counterattacks are pointless. They're just losing men and equipment. They don't have enough heavy equipment to throw in it, and the men they have are worn out. So they're just doing these PR attacks. I mean, it's costing them men. They're losing a couple hundred guys in these pointless counterattacks. But Zelensky needs to show that the Ukrainian army can still do something. He keeps throwing these men into these pointless death charges. They're not moving the Russian lines in any direction. The Russian lines, before they closed in, they dug in well. And you always keep a corridor out for the enemy to psychologically that they think they can still retreat. Because if you fully surround them, you know, then it's standard. It's surrender or stand and die. It's one or two choices. But as long as there's a corridor, there's always that psychological, maybe I can make it out. You know, a gambler said, I mean, if we break, maybe we can get out. But Mirogorod,
on that point, so you mentioned the counterattacks that have been going on. We see especially that around Rodinska, where either the Ukraine side is trying to break out so that the folks that are trapped in Mirogorod can get out, or that they're just fighting the Russians around there to get more men in. Do you have any sense of which one of those two things is going on?
I think they're trying to get out. As always, you know, Ukraine has this great, each army in the world has its own traditions. Ukraine, since 2014, has a tradition of getting themselves surrounded. They can break in, or they stay in too long, and they get surrounded, and they get wiped out. So it's right now it's trying to break out. It's trying to open a corridor to break out. And
so would they do that, though, if they were able to break through at Rodinska? Would those guys who were in Rodinska, who are in Mirnograd, would they exit?
Well, they would try to exit. Look, you know, exiting is... it's near impossible. I mean, right now there is actually a corridor. It's about a kilometer wide, but your chances of getting out of there are slim to none. No vehicles will ever get out because all the roads are covered. You can't get off the roads because if you've never been in that mud, oh, geez. You ever been to Hohenfels?
I have. Spent a lot of time there.
Yeah. That mud is like a little – that mud is nothing. That mud is absolutely nothing compared to this mud. Black earth mud, it'll suck the socks off of you. It may suck the skin off of you. I mean, you're walking, you're just pulling up kilos and kilos of extra weight under you because of the mud. The heavy U.S. equipment and Western equipment, it just sits in that mud and that's it. It's not going anywhere. I watched a video where they had a Max Pro get stuck in that mud. They had three tractors and they couldn't pull that Max Pro out. Big civilian farm tractors. It's not going anywhere. It just sucks in, and it's like cement, except it's still liquid. You're not going anywhere. So the vehicles are gone. You're not going to take any heavy equipment, and they're just running. But they're running across open fields. There's no places to hide. The area is swept by direct fire weapon systems, everything from our field artillery to on a direct fire mode to heavy machine guns, drones, FOBs from aviation, helicopter gunships that will pop up on the edge and just fire off. I mean, you name it, and the tanks are in the hull down position. It's a death valley. So there's no chance. I mean, maybe twosies or threesies, some will get through, but the vast majority are going to be there for until their bodies are picked up.
And so, by the way, just kind of throw this out there just for people's understanding. When I was in the 1st Squadron, 1st Cavalry, actually spent time, this is at Grafenwehr, and I do have some idea what some of that mud is like. This is one of our field exercises where we would add a little bit. So I'm guessing you're talking something like this.
No, much, much worse. That's brown mud.
Much worse. Okay.
At this point, if the mud was that worked up, that truck or that trailer would be hauled down.
Oh, my.
Black mud. Viscous black mud. I mean, you stick a stick into that mud, and it'll grow you a tree. It will grow. Black soil is the best soil you can ever get. Anything and everything will grow in it. It is hyper-fertile. And when it turns to mud, I mean, World War II, both sides would stop and wait. Because until the mud drains off in the spring when the snow melts, or the mud freezes, you know, the German offensive on Moscow started after November. when the ground froze. Yeah, the Germans had to literally pickaxe their tanks out of the ground to get them going again. But that's when it started. When that mud comes, it's over. Infantry can still move. Let me ask
you, because this muddy season is really just beginning. We haven't got to the frozen season yet, as you just pointed out there. So then the question comes in, when it does freeze over, what is going to be the possibility that we finally see some of these larger Russian assaults that are combined to arms operations on a larger scale? Or is that something they're still just thinking about?
They're still thinking about it. I think there's a good possibility. The problem is, you know, the climate has gotten warmer. And, you know, I'm just outside of Moscow. It's the 12th of December. It's plus six outside and raining. We're going to have the first freeze at night on Monday. By minus four, and it'll be plus during the day. Normally, by mid-November, you've got a snow cover. At least historically, by mid-November, you had already a serious snow cover. It's raining, and this is here down south. I mean, this is southern areas, Lugansk and that area, and Donetsk, northern Donetsk, they're warmer. They're much warmer than here. It's 4 or 5 degrees warmer. I mean, you get closer to Black Sea, it gets to temperatures like South Carolina, North Carolina, that type of temperatures. And even the further you go toward like Eastern Black Sea, you're hitting Georgia temperatures. So it rarely ever freezes. You get once in a while. But in that area, I mean, if it's plus six here today, and we're barely getting into an actual, what kind of looks like a beginning of winter, it'll be another month there. And then the question is, will it though? Again, 2022, 24th of December, and it was mud and green grass when we went down there. Even though it was heavy snow in Moscow, probably about 0.5 foot of snow cover, and you get down there and it's all green grass. So it's very hard to tell. And the winters are getting warmer, so it becomes much harder to do heavy equipment because the water is evaporating. It runs off to a certain degree, but it's not evaporating because there's no heat, but it's not freezing either. So you get this quagmire that it used to last for a month and a half, and now you're getting a quagmire that's lasting for 3 months. I mean, last winter, 22 days in January in Moscow were above freezing. We had no snow. All the snow melted off.
Yeah. So now I want to talk to you. Yeah, one of the potential consequences of the Russians not being able to operate with these large scale assaults, which could literally break the front lines and possibly even roll up the defenses, which could end it pretty quickly if they were successful. The fact that they're not doing that allows the other side to believe that it's never going to happen. In fact, I want to go somewhere in just a second, but before I get there, let me ask you one more question, because this is something that's on the minds of many in the West, is that they believe that Russia has gone on this slow grinding pace that's methodical, but it's still quite slow in terms of how much territory, because that's all they can do. Do you believe that?
No, absolutely not. Russia is conserving manpower. The kill ratio right now is hitting about 10, 11 to 1. And it's going to get worse because the Ukrainian side is out of experienced men, and they're just throwing in whatever they can grab to hold whatever or do whatever counteroffensive they can think of at the moment. Like I said, most of these little counterattacks are absolutely pointless. So it's getting worse and worse for their side, obviously for various reasons. One, I mean, the Russian army, there's another 300,000 men outside of Ukraine that are being rotated in. Their brigades are doing rotations, right? So they're coming in for 6 months, and they're rotating back out for R&R. Next brigade comes in for 6 months on the front line, and they're getting combat experience, and they're rotating through brigades and battalions. Ukraine is just, once you get their front lines, you're there till you die, or you run away, or you get wounded enough. I mean, you're looking at 1.8 million killed between Ukrainian soldiers and Mercs. A lot of NATO, we're fighting NATO. Let's begin with that. NATO is already there, unofficially, but there. The Poles have taken around 10,000 casualties. I said, when I was there, down there the first time, there are Polish regular units. They're quote Mercs, right? But, you know, when you have whole battalions that are suddenly quitting, I mean, you know, And I'm talking to guys, and like, yeah, they're all in the same uniforms, they all have the same patches. You know, it's obvious it's one unit. It's not a bunch of people that came in there mismatched and they all got tossed into. Now there's mercenary companies there too. I mean, really mercenary companies. So it's a whole hodgepodge of different things. There are 2,000 Finns that suddenly quit the Finnish military and disappeared. Yeah, they disappeared. They went down to fight. They got sent down there. They get these rotations, combat experience. This is, by the way, one of the reasons Macron is so prone to try to get into Ukraine is he needs to explain why there's hundreds of dead Frenchmen up and down the front line. He can't. And it's bubbled up a couple times in French politics, and it's been a big argument all over that. But he's tampered it down. But if he can get the French army, even the Foreign Legion in there, they'll take massive casualties, and you can just kind of shove the other casualties underneath those lines. And that's the type of politicians we're dealing with in these Western European countries. So Russia is going, as Colonel McGregor said very correctly, it's a big vacuum. Basically, the Russian... Your advancements are, why those guys, by the way, on those pit bikes, advancements are very small groups. They'll take a small position, hold it. The next group comes up, takes the next small position. You don't have big concentrations of men because of high explosive, because you're out in the open, particularly Ukrainians won't, because we've got domination and FOBs. And if you put a battalion, you put a platoon together or even a squad, yeah, they'll probably get a FOB, at least a 250 kilo FOB. But if it's a platoon level, they'll bring a 1,500 kilo FOB or 3,000 kilo FOB, and there's going to be nobody left alive. There'll just be a gigantic crater, amongst other things. So there's no point in bringing large amounts of troops in. Drones also limit how fast which you can move. But on these pit bikes, what they can do is they'll pop in, and they're going full speed, two or three pit bikes with two guys on them. Artillery can't adjust fast enough. By the time they realize they're coming in, you're talking about two, maybe a kilometer and a half, 2 kilometers they need to cover to hit that the first line of defenses. By the time they realize what's happening, they most of the time they can't even get the drones up fast enough before these guys are already on top of whatever position, flushing out and taking out the position, and then they entrench into that position, hold. Get hit by drones, of course, and then the next group comes in, and that's just how you're moving forward. I mean, it's totally different from what you and I were trained to do, and what the Russian military was trained to do, because everybody was trained for these big maneuvers, battalion, brigade, division, corps level maneuvers. It's all changed. I mean, unless you want to take a lot of casualties. Now that the Ukrainian lines thinned out enough from attrition warfare, now you can actually start, even with modern technology that's out there, you can start moving into larger armored fists, because there's not enough drone operators, drones, and everything else to stop you.
Yeah, there's been lots
especially
of
if you do a big breakthrough.
Yeah, there's been lots of reports here in just the last week or so that there are sections of the line where Russian soldiers have been seen moving out in the open because there aren't enough Ukrainian drone operators, and the Russian has counter drone operators themselves, whose only mission is to find the Ukrainian drone operators, because once you knock those out, then it opens up stuff for the troops on the ground. Have you seen evidence of that?
Absolutely. And you know, the anti-drone technology is also growing. I mean, drones have full combat dominance for a while, and they're already starting to lose that. It's the usual offense, defense race. You know, at one point, tanks were unstoppable. All of a sudden, things came out that stopped tanks very well. It didn't mean tanks went away. It just meant that things got more complicated. So there's Chinese laser systems, which are very good. They've been field tested in Russia. They, for a quadruped, for a quadra drone, less than a second before it cuts right through it. For an airplane-style drone, it takes, I think, about like 6 seconds before it's burning. Unfortunately, lasers don't work in fog, and they don't work in very bad conditions. They don't work in rain because of the raindrops will dissipate the laser beam. You got anti-drone drones, shotguns. I mean, you got the whole range of equipment. And the best thing you can do is just destroy the drone operators. And there are systems that will find where the drone operators put in the signal. It's much harder to do with fiber optic drones, obviously.
Yeah.
Right. Drones have their own limits, though. They're not as fast. They're not as maneuverable. They give you a great image. And sometimes you can actually find out if the field isn't totally covered. You can kind of find out where they're shooting from. the drones, because the fiber optic cable is laying on the grass, and if you pull on it, especially if the sunlight's just right, the light will bounce off of it. So you kind of tell which direction they're flying from, especially if they're close enough. So you get these reconnaissance and sabotage teams out there, and sometimes they can find where the drone operators are located by the fiber optics cable,
yeah,
and then call in artillery on them.
Okay.
It's more of an exception than rule, but there's that.
That's what they can do. Right. I get it. Yeah. I want to shift gears here because we're running low on time. I don't want to let you get away before we ask a couple of different things. One is that because of the delay and the slow speed, which the perception in the West is that whatever the reality is, the perception is that Russia's going this slow because that's all they can do. They can't go any faster. So we're kind of safe here. So we can dink around with some other things, and we can actually try different things here, and we have the freedom to do that. One of them, and this was a video here by a guy named John Sweet, who is a defense contractor and an analyst. He has a rather unique explanation or idea for what the West should do now as we enter the 4 year mark of the war.
Saturday evening, he fired 458 drones, 45 missiles, and 32 ballistic missiles at Ukraine, both at those power stations that you make reference to, but also civilian targets in their urban homes. Ukraine right now destroyed, at least according to the Ministry of Defense, they were able to destroy 89% of those drones, but only 20% of the ballistic missiles. 20%, that means 80% of those missiles had their desired effect, that they hit the targets that they were going after. So once again, we're going back to NATO and saying you have to implement a no-fly zone in order to protect Ukraine. You have to. If you don't do that, he's going to continue to exploit what he considers to be a vulnerability. And the vulnerability is to missiles, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. Now, the answer is to stop those missiles, one, from being fired, so attacking the source, which is the launch systems, whether it be a Tu-95 or a MiG-31 or the actual missile launcher on the ground. That's part of the equation. The other part of the equation is the deep strikes, okay, with, if you will, storm shadows, ATACMs, and possibly Tomahawk missiles if the United States could ever get around to releasing them.
So what do you think about that claim there that what NATO, quote, has to do is to just implement a no-fly zone? I mean, that would solve all the problems. What would Russia do if NATO decides to implement a no-fly zone in Ukraine?
I'm sorry, this guy's an idiot. Oh my God, this guy is so whacked in the head. He's an idiot. Don't let him anywhere near anybody make a decision.
He's wearing a suit. He gets paid a lot of money.
God, you know, I've been listening to the various U.S. And British and German generals and all these other people. I hope they're making a lot of money because they're really got this death wish. Look, let's begin with, well, first of all, ATACMs aren't long-range missiles. They're medium theater-level missiles. Why ATACMs aren't particularly used. Now, New York Times has stated it was U.S. generals that requested ATACMs, and they're planning the missions. And I was saying that before, that HIMARS are, those are maybe Mercs or through some company, but those are Americans and Brits. They're not Ukrainians. And I'll tell you one particular reason why, because not a single HIMAR has been bought by Russia. Think of what I'm saying. The way this works is, Russia's bought every piece of equipment that the West has thrown in there. And the way it works is you contact the guys on the other side, you tell them, look, this is how much we're willing to pay for this equipment. They go, okay. And as they're moving away, they bury that piece of equipment, and they send over the coordinates, the money goes into their account, and they mark it off as lost in combat. And everything has been bought, at least one working
model. Wait. You're telling me that Russia has coordinated with somebody on the Ukraine side to purchase some of this equipment, and then they make a deal where they'll bury it, run away, and then the Russians come and uncover it?
Absolutely. It's been since day one. I mean, these guys, you got to understand.
That's kind of new information. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah, I know. I've never been reported, which is funny. That never gets reported. I mean, this was, by the way, being done since 2014. Guys were buying equipment from the Ukrainian army. The rebels in the east, but it accelerates all this new equipment coming in. Abrams tanks haven't been sold, but a lot of this equipment, it gets buried as they're being pushed back, and then they get money. There's contacts going on, particularly there's contacts. Wow. A lot of people know each other. because senior officers, they know each other. A lot of them served together in the Soviet Union. It was only 30 years ago, or their relatives. I mean, but God's sakes, I mean, even Sirsky. Sirsky was born in Russia. His family lives in Russia. Nobody touches his family because we don't do those kinds of things. Ukrainians do those kinds of things. We don't do those kinds of things. His father just got out of the hospital for heart surgery, government paid for. This is the reality of it. And these field commanders, they're getting paid. A lot of them are making money. There's so many corrupt ways to make money. One of them is they're forcing, one of the reasons there's 400,000 missing in action because they're being dumped, their bodies are being dumped, is they don't want to admit they're dead because they continue drawing some kind of salary. And that goes on to that brigade commander's or battalion commander's credit card or debit card, his bank account. So he's pulling them out of that. As long as they're, quote, missing in action, they're still maybe in combat. So they're still drawing a salary, as opposed to if they're dead, they're dead. That's it. Oh, there's massive amount of corruption in every single direction. In there.
So now tell me, what does Russia do with these weapon systems once they purchase them and uncover them? What do they do with them?
Well, what would the U.S. do with them? You take them back, you split them, you take them apart, reverse engineer them, see what's good, see what's bad, see what you can improve on your equipment. Same thing the U.S. does. Same thing every country does. You get somebody's piece of equipment, you reverse engineer it. Let's see what makes it tick. What's good about it? Everybody knows that.
Is that one of the reasons why the HIMARS and the ATACMS progressively are less effective in Russia? Because they figured out a way to defeat them because they have some of these?
No. HIMARS, they don't. That's an interesting thing. Nobody's ever sold a HIMAR. And there's no contacts with any Ukrainians on those HIMARS. Those are Mercs in there or some company. And they're not Ukrainians. So every time a HIMAR goes up, somebody either Americans are getting killed or Europeans are getting killed. By the way, Patriot systems, a full Patriot battery is 94 people. Now, look up how long it takes to train a mechanic for a Patriot system. It's 54 weeks. Officers in the Patriot systems are half a year training. Now, you figure out how many Patriot systems have been destroyed. And you've got to figure out how many Ukrainians did they actually train on Patriots, because they've only started training them after conflict started. So very quickly you start to figure out those aren't Ukrainians sitting on those Patriots. They're either Americans, Brits, Germans, Poles, somebody. So when that Patriot sucks in a Kinjal or sucks in an Iskandar system, those aren't Ukrainians burning up in that. Nobody wants to talk about that. That's a different thing. There's been plenty of Americans. There's been plenty of Brits have been killed along the way. You know, maybe they're paying the families off to shut up. Because I doubt all of them were Mercs. Some of them were Mercs, obviously.
I'm running short on time. I wanted to ask you, what would the Russians do if John Sweet here, what he recommended was actually enacted, and they put in a no-fly zone against Russian assets in Ukraine? What would Russia do?
It wouldn't be a no-fly zone. It would be air combat for air dominance. You would have S-400s, S-500s, S-300s taken out American planes. American planes would be taken out Russian planes. Russian planes would be taken out American planes. You'd have full combat. You'd basically have World War III. It would be instantaneous. That's
Russia
beyond a doubt.
Back off is what you're saying.
Oh, hell no. Okay, for Russia, this is existential. We back off, we die as a country. It goes to nuclear war, then to hell with it. We'll go to nuclear war. That's the point. U.S. can back off. NATO can back off. Russia cannot back off. This is the same thing as if the Soviet Union was in Mexico invading into Texas. U.S. isn't going to back up. This is we'll go to nuclear war before we give up any territory or move out from defending our border. It's the same thing. This is an existential crisis. When a country gets an existential crisis and a nuclear power at that, you really don't want to go down that road, because the next option is nuclear strikes. If it goes down to the point we're losing a war, that war, that means we're going to lose our country, we're going to lose our people. No, that'll go very quickly into escalation, into full escalation. Now, if they try to close the skies over Ukraine, that'll be direct conflict with the Russian Air Force and the Russian anti-air systems. And the Russian S-500s, just so you can understand, they'll pick up anything moving out of Germany. They may not be able to strike it out of Germany, but it'll be on the radar being tracked. And by the time it's in mid-Poland, it's going to get a missile for a hello from an anti-air missile. So that's, I mean, that's the reality of it. If it's a Tomahawk, well, the problem with the Tomahawk is what's the warhead? Is it a high explosive warhead? Is a cluster munition warhead, or is it a nuclear warhead? Well, how the hell do you tell on a radar? All you know is there's a missile coming, and it's a Tomahawk missile. Russia's nuclear doctrine: if there's a missile coming at Russia or at Moscow, particularly, that could be a nuclear missile, is full broadside. It's not going to be a one for one tick for tock. The nuclear doctrine is full release, so that you can very easily escalate to a full nuclear war instantly, just about instantly. So that's not a good idea. And Moscow can't take that risk. Nobody will take it. It's like a missile heading toward, Russia launches Zircon missile from toward Washington. Yeah, sure, Zircon missile is high explosive, but it can also carry a tactical nuclear warhead, 75 kilotons. Is Washington going to wait and find out till it blows up? Hell no. It's going to launch everything it has. It's instant nuclear war. This is the same thing. So these people are talking about this. They're idiots. They don't really realize what they're going down, what road they're going down to. And you cannot do a decapitation strike on Russia, because even if you do, the dead hand works.
Dead hand, yeah.
The dead hand, it's got sensors everywhere in the major cities. It picks up high radiation spikes, earthquake-type tremors, and high temperatures, a nuclear strike. It has 20 minutes before it can be switched off by a human hand. It's not switched off by human hand. It launches one ballistic missile, flies the length of Russia, giving out codes to all the missile carriers out there to launch and coordinates to launch. So all the missiles are on trains, on boats, on roads, secret silos, submarines, everything gets a message, launch everything you have. And there's enough to, there was a study done for the U.S., and Russia's not much different. It takes 47 nuclear strikes to turn the U.S. into a medieval country. And you collapse technology-wise fully. You collapse the U.S. Russia's not much better. I mean, most modern nations are like that. They're actually very fragile. When you take out very certain points, certain cities, certain technology clusters, infrastructure clusters, that's it. It all collapses. You don't need to wipe out an entire country to destroy your enemy, effectively. So, people like that, when they start talking, just want to smack them upside the head with something very hard.
I'm right with you on that. I'll hold him down while you smack him, because that would be catastrophic for everyone. No one would win something like that, and I am adamantly opposed to any use of that. Well, listen, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming on today. Look forward to having you back. I wish we could keep on going here, but we're running out of time, but would love to have you back in the future and get some more questions asked.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be the next couple of weeks, I'll be heading down again, so I'll have some more information what I see.
Love to talk to you when you come back up. I want to hear what's happening back there, and be safe.
Thank you. God loves his fool, so...
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you guys for being with us today. As a reminder, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Let your friends know. A lot of those guys actually prefer to get their information on podcast or DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com, where we have your information from the written and the video. One way or another, we are unintimidated and uncompromising. We want to make sure you get information so that you know what in the world is going on out there. For real, just like some of the stuff you heard today, you've never heard anywhere else. Let your friends know about it as well. Thanks, folks. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.